if a child is triggered, if a child is upset, we cannot count on them to say, I shouldn't do that. This is dangerous. What would happen if I really died? How would that impact everyone? That's not there at the moment. It may come back in, but just because a teenager looks like an adult doesn't mean that they're able to think like an adult in the moment of crisis.
Are you raising your family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice. Welcome back to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah, where we help parents and caregivers raise happy, healthy kids. Today's episode is an important one, but can be triggering as we talk about keeping your loved ones safe and suicide prevention. So we're talking about CALM, Counseling on Access to Lethal Means, a free, evidence-based program that teaches professionals and families how to reduce access to the tools most commonly used in suicide attempts, like firearms and medications. Research shows that reducing access to lethal means can literally save lives. And while this topic can be hard to talk about, it's one of the most powerful things we can do to protect our loved ones. I'm joined today by Sherry Blair and Dr. Georgette Constantinou, who are leading this important work at CALM. Together, we'll talk about what safety measures really work and how to talk with your family about mental health, suicide ideation, and more. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Hi.
Sherry, let's start with you.
Okay.
For parents who may not be familiar, can you tell us what CALM stands for and what inspired the course that you've both developed around it?
Absolutely. CALM, which is Counseling on Access to Lethal Means, is a national program, evidence-based, and one of the most used programs in this field. And basically why we chose this program, A, because it is evidence-based, but also that it just has very easy, practical suggestions for those that work with families on how to talk to them about securing items such as firearms or medications, especially when they might have a child that is vulnerable, either to self-harm or this is just not a good time for them to have access to a firearm or medications.
Georgette, Sherry very eloquently mentioned that the course is evidence-based. What does that actually mean?
Evidence-based means that the material has been subjected to scrutiny by people who have reviewed it. We don't have access to who reviewed it, but we know that for it to come through the Society for the Prevention of Suicide, that they had to have subjected it to scrutiny to be sure that it is valid, that it is replicable, that no matter who's training it, that there's consistency across the country, and that there are good outcomes. So that when I first started working with Sherry, I'd never heard of CALM, and I'm a pediatric psychologist who's been in the field for a long, long time. And when I did the training, the first day I met her, I went home and did the training that night myself, and thought it was very understandable. There were vignettes that gave you actual practice, clinical practice with talking to a father who might not want to put firearms away, helping them to understand why this was necessary. It's really quite an impressive program.
It sounds like there are some key takeaways that parents and anyone taking the course can expect to come away with. Can you talk more about some other key takeaways as well?
Let me start with the first one and then give it back to Sherry. The whole concept of counseling families, a mental health professional or a health professional or school professional, whoever's interacting with that family, is hoping to convince the family to secure all kinds of items, whether it be guns, whether it be medication, safely away from a child or adolescent who is at risk for self-harm, or frankly, with the school shootings that we have to deal with, harm to others. So the idea is to give you distance and time. You're buying time and distance so that that impulsive gesture that might be coming from that child is stalled. Carrie, I'd like you to see to add some more to that, because you do a lot of the calm training.
Yes, please.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So it depends on what the agency might need. So we do, there's a couple different trainings, actually. And I don't know if you want us to go completely into that, but there is a training that is for mental health therapists and counselors. And that's a longer training, but it really does what Georgette mentioned. It gives some of the basic practical tips, as well as the vignettes that they can actually practice and role model. And that way they can be their most comfortable when they're talking to a family and have kind of thought about some of the answers or questions that a family might ask. Then there's actually another program called Calm Conversations, which is something that we do in the community. It's a much shorter presentation. It uses some of the same basic philosophies, but it's much more into the firearm itself and why that securing that firearm is so important, as well as medications. But it doesn't quite go as lengthy because it's hard for families to have 3 hours of time. So it's much shorter, but really taking off at this point. It's a newer program through the Calm Institute.
Sherry, how do you explain to parents, caregivers, and people who are generally distressed why they should consider taking this course?
Now, I think it's a little bit more of trying to be proactive and actually talk with people that are going to help those that are distressed. And so it's really a proactive approach on talking to your family members, talking to your friends when they might be distressed, on how to secure those items so that they're not accessible when somebody's vulnerable. Oftentimes we have families that might say, you know, I've taught my child all throughout their life how to be safe around firearms. We hunt, we respect them, they know not to touch them. However, there's times when kids are vulnerable that where they might actually be thinking about harming themselves. And so that takes that a little bit into a different path. And so by talking about this ahead of time, as to why it's important to have these secure all the time, always have them supervised by adult, because sometimes we just don't know when that child might be vulnerable to hurt themselves or hurt others. And it's not about a respect of the family rules or values. It's really that they're at a vulnerable time, and we want them to make sure that they don't have access. So like Georgette said, we have time and distance from something that could actually kill them, and that allows time for someone, either themselves to change their mind or someone else to intervene.
I wanted to add a few things to that, which is that what we know about child development and what we've particularly learned about adolescence, which is the vast majority of children who try to die by suicide or who make suicidal attempts, is that their brains are just still in a developing stage, that the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that's involved in logical decision-making, thinking things through, planning, all of the things that adults are usually able to do, go offline. And the part of the brain called the amygdala, which is the area that holds emotions, develops first, so that if a child is triggered, if a child is upset, we cannot count on them to say, I shouldn't do that. This is dangerous. What would happen if I really died? How would that impact everyone? That's not there at the moment. It may come back in, but just because a teenager looks like an adult doesn't mean that they're able to think like an adult in the moment of crisis.
If today's episode hits close to home for you, please like and subscribe to the podcast, and please share it with other parents. Stick with me. We have more coming up on prevention and safety. And if you have topics you'd like me to discuss here on Growing Up with Dr. Sarah, reach out to us. Leave us a voice message. Instructions are in the description box below.
And that's just kind of, so when the father says to you, my son hunts with me, they would never do this. Under normal circumstances, that might be true. But in a moment of desperation, in a moment when all the emotions have been hijacked and are running at 150%, that logical mind isn't working at all. Mm-hmm. It's completely gone offline. And I think that's just really important for us to help families understand that. Adolescence is a time of turmoil for some children. We know that there are children who are depressed. Many children who are depressed feel desperate, feel hopeless. And that's where we're trying to intervene by time and have them fail in what it is that they're planning to do at that moment.
I think that's so important that you brought that up. Georgette, thank you for adding that. Because if I'm not mistaken, when we're talking about time, I think I read once that it can be as little as under 20 minutes from the thought of I'm going to get the gun and shoot myself to actually proceeding with the act of hurting themselves. So when we're talking about time, we're not talking about 2 hours, 2 days. Mm-mm. I mean, we're talking about minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that just gives me chills.
But that's what we're trying to delay. Mm-hmm. We're trying to buy, we're buying time.
And that's why talking about lethal means counseling really matters. And some listeners might be thinking, well, reducing access to lethal means is a no-brainer for suicide prevention and general home safety. But Georgette, let's continue with you. And can you explain what makes the process of limiting access to lethal means more complicating than we might think? Why is it such a critical part of the prevention? You've already mentioned some, but let's continue that conversation.
Well, first of all, let's talk about someone who's thinking about hurting themselves, even in an impulsive moment. At that moment, the most important thing is that they don't see any alternatives. They see no other options for themselves. And so somehow they've gotten locked on, if I could only get my father's gun. We also need to put on the table that the teens especially know that uncles and relatives have guns. So if they're not getting them from their home, they may be getting them from a friend's home. They know kind of where to find it. And again, we've seen this even in situations like school shootings, which is a little bit side topic, but still part of this. Those are more planned. You're talking about an unplanned suicidal attempt that may be 20 minutes, even shorter than that.
Even less impulsive.
We don't want teens or younger children, because we're starting to see an increase in younger children dying by suicide. We don't want them to have the means by which to do something that is permanent. Because we talk to many people who have tried to harm themselves, were stopped, got help, and are so very grateful that they had that second chance. And they're not thinking about that in the moment. It's like being in a dark tunnel where there is really no light. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make it safe so that the things that they could use, even let's talk about medications. Medications need to be stored. We've seen teens use their own insulin to try to harm themselves. I'm not here in your pediatrician, Sarah, you know this, to tell parents not to give their children the ability to take insulin for their diabetes. But I'm the child psychologist who says, if you see your child being depressed and unhappy and changing, and their behaviors are changing, then you might have to do something that you weren't necessarily planning to do. You might have to monitor that medication for a period of time. It's all about telling the teen or the child, I love you and I want to keep you safe. Your safety is my number one concern.
Yes, and I think that we can all agree with that. And Sherry, the calm counseling doesn't address the why of suicidal crisis or why people are moved to harm themselves. But instead, the counseling is meant to remove the how. Yeah. Can you explain the effectiveness of this strategy?
Yes, absolutely. It's so important. It's one tool in the toolbox, as people like to say. I mean, it's done in combination of course, with counseling and group therapy, whatever the family chooses is best between them and their therapist. But it allows that time to have that happen. And it's very effective. We have found that as we can restrict those access to the firearms and medications, which are the main two ones this program really stresses, we can see that reduction, hopefully, in suicides. But we also have to think about just overall safety of the family, too. By securing that firearm, young children as young as 2 and 3 can pull a trigger, so that keeps the access away from them. Also, and this is kind of a side thing, a benefit, but if you have easy access to a firearm, say in your bedside table, because you're worried about self-defense, but you don't have any kind of locking mechanism on it, and it's the middle of the night, you're hearing noises in the home, you're grabbing that firearm, very well, you could end up shooting your own family member. Maybe your teen had snuck out and came back in. So by having a locking device that allows for just a couple moments before that you open that, it gives it a minute to step back and say, is this a real threat? And so that's part of that calm training is where can you store it? Where is it safe for you? Is this the time where it needs to be removed from the home completely? For a time period, and then it comes back, or is some other type of arrangement can be done, like a safe or some other locking mechanism. So, that's kind of the whole thought behind it is just to buy a little bit of time for always, but just suicide, unintentional, and someone like a family member that would be, or actually even having the firearm stolen too. It just by having that locked up. Which is another way that people get a hold of firearms.
That's a very good point and something people don't often think about. Georgia, what are some common misconceptions about suicide prevention or safe storage that you often hear, and how can we correct them?
So if you allow me, I'd like to shift it a little bit to misconceptions about suicide.
And yes, let's start there.
If we can. I think the greatest misconception about suicide that families, sometimes even physicians, sometimes even counselors have, is that if you ask a child if they're thinking about hurting themselves, that you are introducing the idea of suicide to them.
Right.
And that I'd like to just blow that out of the water, because you are not giving anyone the idea of suicide by asking them if they are thinking about suicide. And we need to be able to talk openly with our children or our clients or our patients about the state that we see them in. Now, we want to back that up to say, if I'm a parent, that isn't the first conversation I've ever had with my son or daughter. We know that families who nurture their children, families who are loving toward their children, families who are supportive of their children are talking to them all the time. But that doesn't mean they know how to get into this kind of conversation. This is kind of new territory. And so we know our children, we know their moods, we know changes in their moods, we know when they're not eating, we know when they're staying in their room, we know when they're not sleeping, we know when their grades are dropping. And those are the times that we have to be willing to go out on that limb and say, you can talk to me about anything and I'm really worrying about you. To give the reasons why and simply stay open, be willing to listen with every ounce of our being and allow the conversation. I used to say to teens, if I said, are you feeling depressed? They would say, oh yeah, a little. And I'd say, how much is a little? Okay, how depressed are you? Well, very. Of course, I could see. And then I would say, it's a tough question, but I need to ask you, have you thought about hurting yourself? Sarah, that this is going on in all of our pediatric offices at Akron Children's from the age of 12 forward. We're screening for depression. And we've helped many children by them telling us. Children don't want to have those feelings. They want someone to help them. They want someone to stop them. And so asking the question, somebody says, I care about you. And I'm so glad you told me. I always say to someone who's telling me that, thank you so much for sharing that with me. Thank you for trusting me. Thank you for trusting me with your pain and your hurt. Now, I'm here to help you. We're going to do something about this.
I'll tell you, Georgia, I really do appreciate you sharing that. I often, when I am screening in my practice, have parents that are very surprised when they hear even that their child is feeling depressed. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about it in the office, because we do try to have the child fill out their own feeling score. It's called a PHQ-9 for those mm-hmm. that are listening. And maybe your pediatrician or primary care doctor has asked your child to fill it out. And I really want to encourage parents, let your child fill it out. Give them the opportunity to use their voice and then be open to what those results are. Because often, you know, the parents will try to fill it out because we think we know how our kids are doing. And most of the time, I'm not saying that we don't, most of the time we do. So I really do appreciate that you're saying that, bringing up that being open to it, and that screening is so important. Thank you so much for watching and listening to this first part of what is truly an important and life-saving conversation with youth and pediatric psychologists. I know topics like suicide prevention and access to lethal means can bring up strong emotions. And if this episode stirred anything up for you, please remember that you're not alone and help is available. We'll be sharing links in the episode description to learn more about the CALM program, along with additional resources, including free online training designed to help parents and caregivers have these hard but necessary conversations with the young people in their lives who may be struggling. I'll be back soon with part two of this conversation, where we'll dive into practical guidance, when and how to start these difficult discussions with teens, and how to recognize signs that depression, anxiety, or trauma may be playing a role. In the meantime, if you have questions, reflections, or thoughts you'd like to share, I'd love to hear from you. Please feel free to leave a comment or send me an email. My address is in the box below. Thank you for being here, for showing up for the kids and teens in your life, and for being part of this community. I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, and let's grow up together.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.